둘, 셋, 파!
For Hey Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Hello, and welcome to Long Time No See, the podcast. Each week, we'll be pairing two blindfolded comedians who've agreed to sit down with a mystery guest. I'll be putting them on the spot with a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Without further ado, please remove your blindfolds and introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Michael.
Hi, Andrea.
I have to be honest with you, I am so relieved to see it's you.
Do you have any irrational fears? What's the worst fad you were into? Is there any job that you would be terrible at?
Underwater welder?
Don't say that about yourself.
Do you guys have any useless talents?
I kicked one of those delivery robots.
Got what? You kicked one?
Yelling. I kick those all the time.
They have names on them.
Good.
I can make smoke come out of my mouth with nothing.
Do it.
You want to see it?
What the f***? Are you a dragon?
Out now, Long Time No See the Podcast, Season 2. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcast and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead. Download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach.
The Star Wars universe is constantly expanding.
But how the heck are you going to keep tabs on it without a holocron? And where in the rim can I score the juiciest news and rumors?
Ah, you seek State of the Empire, Consequence of Sound's Star Wars speculation podcast, where we look for news in Alderaan places.
We dig into the Sarlacc pit of the internet for the hottest intel in the galaxy far, far away. Make Indiana Jones inquiries and keep watch for the latest on Willow.
Find us on consequenceofsound.net or wherever you procure fine podcasts. It's the show you're looking for. Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's an audio interview series presented by WFPK Independent Louisville at WFPK.org. Consequence of Sound and the Consequence Podcast Network. Give it a little subscribe tap there, wherever you're listening from right now. Of course, you can subscribe at iTunes and Apple Podcasts over at Spotify. You can subscribe at YouTube, wherever you get your favorite podcast from. Go ahead and hit that before we get started here. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today, my guest is Josh Ritter. Known Josh for a long time, done a lot of interviews with Josh over the years concerning a lot of great albums that he's been a part of. This one is no exception. Fever Breaks, one of his best records yet, I promise you that. We talk about how he teamed up with Jason Isbell and used the 400 Unit as his backing band, and beyond that, some of his other collaborations, like with Bob Weir from the Grateful Dead and Joan Baez. We'll, of course, dig into the new record, Fever Breaks, to talk about its darkness and political overtones. He compares it to the Animal Years record, and we'll discuss how the current landscape influenced a lot of the songs. Of course, it's not all doom and gloom. We'll also discuss a track called I Still Love You, writing about love that's more consistent. And yeah, there's, of course, some anniversary talk. It just so happens to be the 20th anniversary this year of his self-titled debut record. And from here, he's going to be a part of a big Van Morrison tribute that's happening at Carnegie Hall. It's all coming up. Kyle Meredith with Josh Ritter.
Hi, how's it going?
Well, dude, Fever Breaks, it sounds great. I mean, you're 20 years doing this, and I'm still surprised every single time I get a Josh Ritter record that I've never had the artist fatigue that I think I have with a lot of even my most favorite artists.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. That's a huge compliment.
I know. Let me start with the studio then, because I feel like, you know, there's a lot of great studios in the country, and you've probably been in a lot of the rooms, but there seems to be something extra special about when someone steps in RCA Studio A in Nashville. Like, is it different? Do you feel that there's a big difference in that room than other places?
Yeah, it was. I first went there. I was working on another project with writing some stuff with Bob Weir, and that was to step into that room for the first time was incredible, and then to be actually in it recording my own music was such a thrill. I mean, that's where they recorded Jolene and, you know, the Everly Brothers and Elvis and just to be in that room, which is so large and so still. The air in there is like still like it is inside a cathedral. It's really a special place, and you'd lose all track of time. It's a really impressive room.
You talk about Bob Weir and going from that, you know, into working with Isbell and his team this time. I don't know. Is that just coincidence, or does collaboration? I mean, it seems like it's more important to you right now than maybe it ever has in the past.
You know, I think that collaborating has been something that I don't know why it's taken me so long. You know, there's so much of the time that I've worked, you know, primarily on, you know, within a smaller group of people, and immensely like talented, like rewarding, wonderful people. And but starting to work with folks like Bob and then working on Fever Breaks and that incredible crew, it's really opened my mind up to maybe some places that I could improve in my songwriting and my artistic life, and that is you know opening up my ideas to the ideas of others.
Let's just take that one then. I mean, teaming up with Jason Isbell, you two are what I would call two of the most lyrical powerhouses in songwriting of this generation, anyway. And I don't know. I seem to just recall sudden wrestling metaphors from the 80s, you know, like Macho Man and Hulk Hogan. I mean, there has to be some kind of push and pull when you've got two people that's sort of your bread and butter, I guess.
I felt like it was an idea that to me made a lot of sense. As time went on in my writing and in my recording, you know, I'd done all kinds of stuff, but I had never worked with somebody whose spot behind the microphone was the same as mine. You know, I never worked with somebody who was like, you know, occupied that same space. And, you know, I had met Jason over the years and here and there, but you didn't know him all that well. But when I went on tour with him and Amanda and his band, it was a real great moment for me. I was seeing somebody who was making some of the same, you know, choices in life as I have made, and who is on the road with his family and was writing these songs that were just knocking me out, you know. It was a really cool thing. So when I was starting to think about working with somebody, I started to really think about him a lot. And that's when the idea kind of came.
Yeah, and then with him bringing on, you know, the 400 unit to that, I mean, that only not only brings sort of a rockness bigger than maybe you've had in the past, but but they also tend to bring a certain darkness that I feel like is, I mean, you've done dark before, but this, I guess, is a different tone of that.
Yeah, it's amazing that you know, I always think that in this process in particular, I've noticed that the song that I meticulously craft in you know, at home by myself, you know, in my room under controlled environment, you know, that thing, as soon as I set it loose with the musicians, that turned into something completely different, you know, each time. It was a really incredible thing to watch and to be a part of, was the way this band took stuff that was, some of it, you know, kind of out there, and took it and played to it their best strengths. I was really fortunate to be able to work with them. They're terrific people too.
You know, I bring up some of the darkness too, and I've read that you find a certain kinship between Fever Breaks and Animal Years. What is that? What is it between those two records?
I would say that, like, both of those records, both Fever Breaks and Animal Years, are inspired by and prompted by the political moment that we're in. You know, the Animal Years during the George W. Bush administration, and this during this really painful moment in our history. I think that there are times when surrounding events become so overpowering that even like somebody who's like generally circumspect is pushed to like write about it. I think it's just a really strange and dark time.
And some of those songs, I mean, again, these are some of your most standout songs. So, the Torch Committee, All Some Kind of Dream. What's the challenge of writing a song like that, you know, to be so reflective of something as specific as what's going on?
Well, I think that the main thing that I would always like hope is that like the songs aren't educational. You know, you're not attempting to bring somebody over to a way of thinking. But if they're describing a situation, and in describing a situation, that's when I think we make human connection. You know, we can speak to each other in ways that are easy to understand, and that we can all draw our own inferences from. But I feel that the weakness of a lot of times of political writing or of political songwriting or that thing is that it struggles to be educational rather than to reflect the time period that it's written in. And also Some Kind of Dream, all I wanted to do is put out in the starkest possible ways the things that I was seeing, and placing them against this window of political activism and things that stretches back to the civil rights era, and say, are we living up to our own heritage that we speak so lovingly of? And the same with the Torch Committee was I wanted to just talk about authoritarian government and the impossible choices that you're given when living under one. And I don't feel like they're educational so much as they're just trying to set out in imagery what I see going on around us.
You know, I've lived through all the same news that you have, but when you get to, you know, the verse in All Some Kind of Dream about, you know, the kids and families in the holding tanks, like, I know that news story, but still, you know, there it is in the song, and it's still just sort of a jaw-dropping moment, and then to hear you, you know, pull that line where, you know, I hope it's all some kind of dream. It's like, I mean, that's a damn great moment. Full compliments there.
Well, thank you. It's like, you know, there's times when becoming too specific can be a hindrance in a song, but there's times when not being specific would be a waste of space. So I appreciate that. I really do.
Would I be too far off with calling that song pretty Dylan-esque in the way it's written?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you know, we all have grown up in the shadow of Bob Dylan, but like that, he's such a clear touchstone for song for that particular style of kind of expression, I think.
And this sort of in the same world too, because here you've re-recorded Silver Blade, a song that you originally gave to one of Bob's old duet partners, Joan Baez, for the Whistle Down the Wind record. What made you want to take that one and you know, a song that you wrote and go ahead and do it yourself?
Well, I actually thought that I had written it in the same period of time, so I felt like it had a kind of a spiritual kinship with the rest of the songs on Fever Breaks, and it was a song that when I was first had gone down to Nashville and was hanging out with Jason and Amanda at their house, that was one of the songs that I played for them and was really, we kind of played together as a trio, and it just felt really great. To me, it felt like it fit into the song it filled the song fit into the rest of the record in a really specific way that made me feel like it belonged.
You know, obviously, you know, as we talk about, you've written Topical before and everything, but I feel like, you know, backing up a little bit, working with someone like Joan Baez, I mean, that's, does that add some depth to your well, what you're able to pull from in moments like this?
Yeah. You know, like, I'm really lucky that early on in my career, I got a chance to work with people like Joan who have been doing it their whole lives. And, you know, that kind of longevity is something that I feel, you know, really drawn to. I love doing what I do, and I'm drawn to the people who seem to be doing it for the same kinds of compulsions and reasons. That, like, I think it's wonderful, you know? And so I was really lucky to get to work with her really early on, and in some ways she kind of like taught me how to first live on the road, you know, like in a certain way.
So the other side of the record, I mean, it's not all political songs. There are some great sounding, or seemingly sounding, personal songs on here as well. And a couple of those I wanted to ask about. The record starts off with "Ground Don't Want Me," and that's sort of one I haven't cracked myself yet. What's the story there?
Well, the story is one that kind of came to me as like a guy who's kind of cursed. He's a person that's so evil that even the ground doesn't want him, and all these acts of evil that he continues to do, you know, take him further and further away from peace. And it was an unsettling song, and I thought it was a really fun one to rock out with the band, and it was, so I thought it would be a good kind of jittery first number for the record.
I love it. It was one of my favorites right from the beginning, and then you get to a song like "I Still Love You," and I thought there's writing about new love, which, you know, pop and rock have done for the ages to great degree and very corny degree at the same time. But writing is something about what sounds like consistent love also seems like it would have its own challenge.
Yeah, and I think it requires a little bit of, there's an honesty to first expressions of love, you know? Like, you know, there's, because they're so they're so insistent, you know? But a long-term love and a confession of that seems like it's done less often in songs. I guess that's really true. But this was one that I started working on in the middle of a long tour, and I just kind of had in my back pocket for a while, not quite knowing how or, you know, what sort of record it would form a song like around it. And it was one that just really jumped naturally to my head when we started working together.
It does add a nice balance to the record on top of all of that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Beyond this stuff, you know, this year, if I've got my math right, this is the 20th anniversary of your self-titled debut, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Are you going to be doing anything with that?
I really should. I've been busy with Fever Breaks that I haven't really, you know, thought about the fact that I've been doing this for for 20 years, and I remember still getting the box of CDs that I ordered back from the CD manufacturing company, and realizing that 2,000 CDs was a lot more than I was probably going to be able to sell, and I'm still grateful to my parents for letting me store all those records down in the basement.
Hopefully those have sold by now. Hopefully those have long since. I know coming up too, I saw that you're part of a tribute to Van Morrison at Carnegie Hall March 21st.
Yeah.
What an incredible, you know, the lineup list looks great. I know, you know, you've got sort of an Irish connection, especially considering your early days over there. Do you have a straight connection to Van Morrison too?
I don't. I have, like, but he's in the water, you know, and the myths of him are many, you know. So I'm pretty excited to like get a play that I'm going to have an amazing time, and it's Carnegie Hall. I'm so excited.
Yeah, no pressure there.
Yeah.
Do you know what you're doing already? I don't know if you're allowed to say it or not.
Yeah, I'm going to do a song called "Lyndon Arden Stole the Highlights," which is a beautiful short story kind of song off of Eden Fleece.
Oh, Oh wow! And I look forward to I look forward to whatever bootleg video surfacing of that one, so I can check it out.
I'm really excited about it.
Well, Josh, it was a pleasure talking to you as always. Congratulations on Fever Breaks, thanks, man. It's fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I hope I didn't ramble too much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Always enjoy talking with you, and look forward to seeing you out on the road, maybe in Louisville later on in the tour.
Hell yeah, definitely.
All right, man. Take care.
Right. Thanks, Scott. Bye.
And a big old thank you to Josh Ritter talking about the new record, Fever Breaks.
With the novel coronavirus pandemic escalating in the U.S., Roe, the parent company of Roman, is offering free telehealth services for people seeking guidance and information on COVID-19. Their free online assessment is based on guidelines from the CDC and the World Health Organization and can help determine if you are at risk. If appropriate, Roe will connect you with a medical provider for a free consultation. Visit roe.co/coronavirus on your phone or laptop to complete a free online assessment. That's roe.co/coronavirus.
Now, as I mentioned, Josh and I have talked a whole lot of times over the years, so I thought I would include some of those here as a little bonus interview time. And we'll start with a 2017. This is the last time I talked to him before this new interview. It was behind his 2017 record called Gathering, where this time around, the themes of darkness had more to do with the weather. And soup. We talk about soup, too. It's part two of Kyle Meredith with Josh Ritter.
Hey, this is Josh Ritter.
It's another fun record, a beautiful record. You always tend to do that. I don't think I've ever called one of your records even halfway bad. So the Gathering is...
Thanks a lot.
There's one thing you said about it, you know, in your write-ups that really caught my eye. And I guess it's sort of where the album starts, about trying to get away from... You felt like you were tied to your old stuff. And I was thinking about that and, you know, the way you're dragging your old luggage around. And I guess songwriters are forever tied to their younger selves, which I would be really annoyed if I had to deal with my younger self all the time. So,
well, I feel that just over time, I don't feel that you know, and I've never been the type to believe that you outgrow your material. Like, whenever I put a song on a record, it's because I want to be able to like hear it and like it, and in 40 years, that's my, I want it to live on. And so it's funny that what I really want to do every time is change the direction that I'm going and try and move off into territory that continues to inspire me. I always want to just keep on moving in a direction that surprises me. So, you know, I guess that just means a lot of times you start off with a blank page and no idea really where you're going to go. But that's kind of what makes it so exciting, is not knowing what's going to happen next.
And you did a lot of the work in progress shows, I know, leading into that. Like, how important of a part did those play in creating this record?
Oh, they're so important. I realized that I've been taking myself so seriously. Like, I wanted to keep the songs really close to my chest until they were out on a record. And then I realized, you know, like, these are songs, I'm writing them. I want to see what they're going to do. You know, you never know what a song is going to do on stage. And part of like wanting to do these shows that were works in progress was that I could see what needed what. It's not that I was basing my decisions on the reaction of the audience, but I could tell, like, when I'm performing for somebody, what a song needs for it to be performable by me. And it was a really exciting time, really fun. I had such a good time doing that.
I mean, that's a really bare way of putting yourself out there. I think a lot of artists used to do that much more before the internet age, and they sort of got scared, you know, scared off of it, because that meant, you know, early versions of their songs was out. I don't think a lot of artists could muster having, you know, those early versions floating around out there.
It is funny. It's like, it's bracing, you know. You just like, and some versions of the songs are completely different. You know, there's whole sections and parts that I'll have taken out or put back in. And it's only, you know, it's a song will just, it's a such a living thing, you know. It only exists for a few minutes, and then it's free to be created again, you know, in a whole different way. It's really a great freedom that you have as a musician, that you know, it doesn't exist quite the same in, say, like in like writing a novel.
And fans are probably, you know, pretty used to that with you, although I would guess that there's probably some really hardcore fans who get demo-itis on those first listens and be like, oh, man, no, I liked it so much better the way.
Totally. They're all, that's exactly right. You got to just strike out and go for whatever feels like it keeps the fire really burning. And for me, getting to see a song transform and change over time, for instance, When Will I Be Changed, which is on the record, the new record, was a song that I wrote and which recorded, and it didn't, it was there, it was done, but there was something still kind of like told me that it could use something. And then I realized that, like, I've been doing all this work with Bob Weir, and it would be so great if he could sing on the song with me. And so he came in and recorded with me on that, on When Will I Be Changed. And it was just like, just a magical, it added something magic.
I love the work you guys did together on his record too. Just beautiful stuff. That last record that, you know, I mean, every record, I wouldn't say that you've written too many concept pieces, but every record seems to have that general theme. And I know the last one sort of hit on religion and small town life and home and things like that. But I get the feeling that this one was much more of an internal as far as lyrics go.
When I'm working on songs and I'm really going full steam, like I find that I'm kind of like I'm watching the, I'm going really fast and just watching the road. I don't have a chance to look up at the scenery, and it's only when the record is done that the themes like start to pop out at me, and I start to see the scenery. And the thing that Gathering really took the shape of was storms. You know, storms are all over the record, and in the artwork that I was doing at the time, it was just something that kind of, and a lot of that storming would be like interior, you know, against yourself, against, you know, all kinds of questions about yourself and who you are and what you believe, and then there was the physical storms like lightning and thunder and rain and things that were just all over the record. It was really interesting to see those things kind of jump out, and I feel that no matter what, it's like you try and like not write autobiographically, but it always comes out, you know, as something that was made by a person during a certain time, and this is a stormy time.
You know, there may be storms, you know, inside of you, but there are certainly storms raging all around the world right now. So I'm not surprised. Yeah. You know, you and I talk about a lot of the same things, especially on social media, on Twitter, and I think I'm more surprised that this isn't an overtly political album, you know, that didn't just come roaring out of you like that. I love the way you kind of internalized it, but
you know, it's always interesting. You can never like write what you think should happen. It's like it always has to just kind of come out the way it does, you know. But more and more I've found that I have a whole other voice that I want to speak with, and you know, and it's not always the same one that writes the songs.
You mentioned that the paintings before too. I mean, there's a much stronger visual representation this time around. You know, and I guess there's always sort of, you know, that marriage that you do with every album, but this one seems pretty personal as well with these paintings.
You know, the paintings are just something I really love to do. Like, there's no, you know, I have them and they're piled up, and the beauty of doing them is that they're just, they quiet down and kind of cool off my brain for a while. You know, they're something that it just brings me real pleasure and calm to sit and work on something, even if it's a stormy picture. It's something that I really enjoy, and I've kind of found as my own trip to therapy.
Well, it makes being a fan that much cooler, you know, to kind of get all of these sides of an artist. So I appreciate what you're doing. I'll end on, you and I have something else in common, a big thing, and that is soup. I've said many times that if I get the choice as my last meal, it's going to be soup and tea. Although if you've got soup, you don't even need tea. It's all in one. I've heard people ask you what you're reading, and I know you're a big reader. I might end this with asking you, what soup am I going to try tonight?
Oh, well, you know, I think you should definitely go for my partner Haley's chicken tortilla soup. I can send you the recipe. It's tremendous.
All right. I love chicken tortilla soup. All right, Josh, thanks so much for calling in, and thanks for this record. It's really another fantastic one.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Kyle. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
We'll see you next time you're down here in Louisville.
Absolutely.
All right. Take care, man.
Josh Ritter from back in 2017 talking about his record called Gathering. Head even further back now, 2014. He was actually between records when we had this conversation right here. It was on the way to writing one, had just written with Bob Weir of the Grateful Dead, as we talked about in the first interview of this episode. He had also just become a family man at this point, a brand new father and a husband. Part three of Kyle Meredith with Josh Ritter.
How's it going?
I'm all right down here. I appreciate you taking some time. I know you're not really on a press run right now, so.
Yeah, I'm just I'm you know, we're digging out from the winter up here and getting the garden in. It's great.
What are you planting? What's in the garden?
We got like all kinds of you know, beets and carrots, radishes. We got lots of bitter greens, which are, you know, it's mustard and that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Do you both cook?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny, going, you know, coming home, especially like after like a year, you know, like, it's just nice to just kind of ease into all that stuff and it, you know, take your time with it. It feels so good.
Yeah. Have you always been that way? Did you grow up like knowing how to garden and do all of this stuff, or did you find that later in life?
Well, you know, Haley really runs the garden. I think like I was, you know, definitely always. Like, we grew up, my brother and I, outside, and definitely that's, we're around the garden and everything like that. It's really nice to be, to kind of fold back into that kind of world.
Yeah. That's a nice trade to have, too. I mean, you'll survive during the apocalypse this way.
That's what we're hoping, you know? Yeah, it's like we're trying to grow anti-zombie vegetables, so.
That's different from, like, garlic for vampires, though.
Yeah. They're not huge vegetable eaters anyway, you know,
it's
zombies.
True. Well, the old joke, you know what a vegetarian zombie eats?
What?
Grains.
Yeah.
And that's how we start this whole thing out. That's all. Well, let's I guess we should direct to the music here. And where we've last left you, and where our movie is left off, is you did a nice little re-release on Historical Conquests.
Yeah, totally. That's like... my record that I, you know, I've been lucky enough to hop from major label to major label for a couple years there, and you know, always a cool, interesting experience, you know, but I always found that it's been nice to be back on my own label, and when Conquest came back to me, the rights to it, then I was really excited just to get it pressed up on vinyl and like put out some B-sides and do some of the stuff that I'd wanted to do but hadn't been able to do with that one yet.
Yeah.
So that's totally satisfying.
Yeah, how hard is it to get your rights this day and age?
Well, I don't know. I think it's, you know, it's completely based on an individual basis. I think that, you know, it's good to look at a record label as a, you know, as any kind of business relationship, is one that's like, you know, you have to expect them to work in their own best interest.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to expect you to work in your own best interest. I'm very Hamiltonian when it comes to that view of human nature. I definitely think that like you can't expect people to work against their self-interest. So I always make sure that like that you know the records will always return to me after a given amount of time.
Yeah.
And that's always in the contract to begin with. I just think that's you know, not just me, but like the lucky, I mean, the people I get to work with, which
are
really smart, cool people.
It's an interesting little dance, and it sounds like you're very good at the industry dance.
Well, I don't, you know, I think that, you know, being on a major label is really fun and really cool, and when you have like a thing working for you, like even to the degree that it worked for me, is like it's really cool. But in the end, it's, you know, I think that stuff is flattening out to such a degree now that it's, you know, you can have the major label experience by yourself, if you want.
It's true. It's true. Yeah, and you've become very, very known for that. I mean, you took your career in your own hands, and seem to be quite successful at that at this point.
I think, you know, I think that it is, like, I feel good about it. You know, it's you know, there's times when, you know, I certainly think, you know, Darius, my manager, and like, and the people that I work with that help, you know, do the label, really run that stuff. So, you know, it's a hard, big job, but in the end, you can be more creative, you can be smaller, you know, you can, I love that we can do like reissues of stuff, and they don't have to be, you don't have to worry about getting like in every store or anything like that. You can be more creative. That's a real thrill to do that.
Yeah, would you ever see any reason, and you know, who knows what the future holds, I'm sure, but for you to say, you know what, for this project, though, I'd like to work with a label, big or small?
Oh, absolutely. I think you know, as with anything, it's a lot like when you mix a record. Sometimes you've been living with a record for 6 months, and you need somebody who has a fresh pair of ears and fresh ideas to hear it. And a lot of times the people at record labels, if you choose the right one, are really great, really artistic, cool people, and want to run. You know, they want to go, and that's, I think it's always in your best interest to hand it over if you find the right team of people.
Yeah. So you got the rights back to Conquest, and I kind of find it really fascinating. Artists' relationships with their past, I guess, because it's so varied. You have some people that say, oh, I never go back to my old records. I never listen to them, you know, and they just don't like to think about them. And you have other ones that it almost feels like, you know, they don't mind flipping through the yearbook and saying, oh, look at my goofy haircut at
sure.
that time.
Totally.
And how is it? Because, you know, this is an earlier record of you. How is it looking back on something like this? I mean, was it at all painful where you can listen to it and go, oh man, so many things there I would have done different. I never would have had that haircut.
Well, I think I think that you have to make the choice. You have to make the choice what you're going to be. And for me, I always feel like if I'm to disown that stuff, then I'm disowning myself and my artistic vision at the time. And luckily, you cannot see forward into the future. But you can kind of hope that the records you're making, you'll be able to listen to in years to come. And I think the only way, like sounds aside, or, you know, whatever that should be, like it should always be, you know, can I listen to this in 40 years? And I always believe that, like, unless it passes that test, it shouldn't go on the record. Like, and that's for me. I just went to, you know, the phenomenal Neil. I was out in Chicago playing, and I got the chance to see Neil Young play. And you know, it's gratifying to know that somebody is not afraid to jump back into stuff that they did when they were 20. You know,
right.
I think that stuff can only get better.
It's true. That must have been an amazing show. I heard so many things about the reviews on that show too. All of that tour that he's been doing lately.
He's like a wild man.
Yeah,
he's awesome. I love that really like beautiful playing and kind of this weird kind of moving around all these different instruments I really thought it was great. It was a real treat.
Yeah, have you been following his whole thing about his Pono player?
I just vaguely, you know, not being an audiophile like to that degree,
right.
I find that I go for convenience over too much, but that's just me, you know.
No, I feel like that's going to be its biggest obstacle because most people are like that. I mean, you and I both work in music at different parts, but we're both in music. I'm even working in a part where I listen to music daily, but it never occurs to me that there's a whole saying of you don't know what you don't hear, you don't know what you're not getting, or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I wouldn't know otherwise that I wasn't getting everything. And I mean, I believe in it. I'd love to see it take off, but it's like that. It's like, well, you know, a convenience, you know, right
well,
there.
Well, I remember when I was working when I was doing the record with V2, and I did Animal Years with V2. I remember we, you know, this is my first time like with like an idea for singles and all that sort of stuff that I could see and be around in. And I remember a couple of guys from the label going down, you know, three or four flights to the street to get in one of the guys' cars to drive around and hear what it sounded like through car radio so that they would know what to do, you know. And I do think that there's a way to like to be an audiophile, but and really have that and make it as good as you possibly can. If you like good chocolate, like go find a good chocolate, you
right,
know.
Right.
But I do like the idea of somebody being able to pick it up and play it however they want, you know. Which is great.
Yeah, at least we have the option, I guess.
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
yeah. I have something written down here on my notes: Historical Conquest versus the Beast in its tracks. And I have that there because of the album title. It's the first time I've ever noticed that it's the beginning of a story and the sad end of a story.
Interesting. That's really true.
Yeah.
That's funny. Yeah. I never thought of that.
It's some amazing. Some kind of bravado that goes along with that, like you know, the conquest and then the beast. Of course, what's not there is the word stopped.
Yeah, you know, yeah, totally. You
know, so,
yeah, that's like there is like a I remember that time and like you know that was my first record with Sam Kassir and it just seemed like we were making a big cool like comic book, and it felt like you know big colorful pictures and you know splashy and lots of symbol, and I thought that was like really fun and conquest, so it felt like you know real saber rattling.
I like the role playing in music.
Yeah,
I don't think enough people do that.
No, it's so fun, man. It's so fun.
Yeah, it's the I don't want to use the word bravado again. It's the whole. I mean, I love the idea of rock and roll. I guess I talk about this a lot in my interviews. I love the idea of rock and roll. You know, the mysticism that's been built up over the years. You know, and the mystery and all of that stuff. But you've got to have stuff like that. You've got to have, you know, to be able to lose yourself, even if it's not in a character, just in the fun of what it can be.
Yeah, certainly, totally,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And every record is so different. Like every you know every record that somebody makes is going to be different, and there's always a story there somewhere in there about how it came together and why it exists in the first place. So
right.
I think that's so cool.
And that's what interviews are for.
Yeah.
Just fill in the space. With The Beast and its tracks, I mean, every one of your records has the stories. Of course, now we look back on that one, and everyone says there is Josh Ritter's divorce record. That is the divorce record. And you're past it now. Are you happy to be kind of finally out of that and moving along?
Yeah, you know, it's like it was funny even at the time, like even as the record was finishing, how I felt like I was past it. I was,
right.
You know, it was never the big moment of I have like kind of. I've you know excised this pain, you know, but I found that during the process of starting to feel better mimicked the process of making the record in this really cool reflective way. I thought that and then we jumped right into tour and I had a baby and I discovered this whole other way of writing that I maybe rediscovered it and you know things have just been going gangbusters since then. You know, just the writing has been so much fun. You know, so I think that like I felt like the transition back into like a real happy life was amazingly seamless.
Yeah,
I'm very happy about that.
Yeah. So have you got an update on this these songs you're writing? A style? I mean, I'm guessing there's got to be some influence there in the family life now.
I think the influence there is like you know. I'm definitely not the guy that's going to be writing like, you know, like children's songs or a children's record. I think like, you know, I would shelter them from that. But you know, also I want my daughter to still think I'm cool when I'm
right.
When I'm, she doesn't need me singing her song. I would say that the songs have gotten very they're just really fun. I kind of like after Beast and its tracks, I stumbled on writing that I felt was much more lighthearted and less, but what's come in alongside that has been this really awesome, surreal kind of polleny like richness, which I'm really excited about, and I'm really happy with how that stuff is going. You know, it's really exciting stuff,
yeah.
And for me, you know, it's like, and I know that's like a good sign.
Yeah, I mean, I love The Beast and its tracks, but I'm really interested in a bit more of a lighthearted Josh Ritter. So
it's gonna be really fun, and you know, and alongside that, I'm working on writing a bunch of songs for a record that Josh Kaufman who did Bring in the Darlings, and he did a lot of the stuff on mm-hmm. on Beast and its tracks. So I'm working on a record that he's producing of for Bob Weir. So I'm writing a bunch of songs for Bob Weir, which is really exciting too.
That's awesome. So this is all happening at once. I mean,
yeah, it's good.
It's work.
It is, but you know, like you know, when you're hanging out with and you have a primary responsibility, which is to watch the kid, you know,
mm-hmm.
and out in the country, make sure she's not eaten by saber-toothed tigers or falls off cliffs or like goes on some incredible journey without me. You know, I find that like you know, I carry. It goes back to how I first started, which is, you know, going around. You got to like a notebook and you only have like you know you have time to write down one or two things and then you have to do something else. You have to go to your job or do something else, and it's been the best thing for me. You know, yeah. It's been the best. I don't have like 9 hours a day to think thoughts. You know, I have to run around, and it's been the best thing in my life for my creative side.
Yeah, that's amazing to hear. Is there a big plan at this point as far as when all of this music might make it out into the world?
I think, you know, like right now the tap is on, and I've always been wary of like when that happens, mm-hmm. to make any plan yet. I know there's way more than enough for like a record, but I want to see where the rest of it kind of sifts out, and you know, and see what kind of record I want. I feel like whatever record I want to make, I want it to be like, I just want it to be a really stellar record, and I don't really feel like I have room to make anything but a stellar record right now. I really want to make something great, and I'm having the best time of my life doing it too.
Well, you set the bar high for yourself with every record that you've done so far, so we expect nothing less, Mr. Ritter.
Thank you very much, Scott.
No problem, dude. Well, cool. Well, I'll let you get back to your life and your family, and I can't wait to hear when the new music comes out. Whenever it does, we'll be here waiting and listening and ready.
I can't wait to come visit. I'll be there. I'll be sometime soon, I'm sure. Yeah,
you're always welcome.
Thank you, and stay out of the heat.
All right, thanks, man. You too.
Bye-bye. Bye.
It's Josh Ritter from back in 2014. Now, just right before that, 2013, that's one of the first times we caught up to talk about his record, The Beast in Its Tracks. It's what was known as his divorce record, but really it was about much more than that. It's about getting back on your feet after a commitment comes to an end. Part 4 of Kyle Meredith with Josh Ritter.
Welcome. It's great to see you here.
Thank you.
Enjoying the new record, The Beast in His Tracks. There's the story behind this one. The story, yeah. I'm sure that you're talking about at this point. we're gonna get into it. I mean, it's basically like it comes down to are you gonna sing about love or are you gonna sing about love lost?
It's the classic songwriter dilemma.
Yeah, right. Well, and that's one of the things, though, because as a songwriter, I mean, the love song is the most classic pop song, mm-hmm. one way or the other. And while you've written types of love song, I mean, as it's been told, this is the first time where it's your love song.
Well, I think that love, I think the reason why love songs are so, this huge kind of bubble of songs, huge cloud of topic of a love song is because it's a story, you know, and stories are the reason for songs, you know, and when love gets lost, that's a story, and when love gets found, it's another story, I've always enjoyed writing those songs, mostly because I enjoyed writing stories, but like I never claim them ever as my own because I don't really believe in autobiography and song. Mm-hmm. I think that so many people do it. I think it's way overdone. I think it's often done really badly. And I also don't want to hear someone talk about themselves all the time.
Sure,
you know.
Sure.
So I was talked smack about it, and then my divorce came, and I realized that there was nothing else for me to write about. Yeah. I had to write about it.
Well, I mean, it's got to come around there eventually, you know, if you're writing so many records. Something like that's going to happen, whether it's that or whatever it is, something mm-hmm. personal is going to happen.
Yeah.
And I heard you say once that what you'd like to take away from this is not people looking at you, but to connect in their own scenarios or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I guess that's really been the interesting thing about it because all of us have been there.
Yeah.
You know, we've all had our heart broken. And to get on this, you know, it's like, sure, there's the star quality of it. This mm-hmm. is Josh Ritter. We put Josh Ritter on a pedestal because mm-hmm. he's written these great songs and we've loved him and we're interested in his life. But at mm-hmm. the same time, it's like, yeah, but I've done that.
I take my cue from Leonard Cohen, who always says, like, if you sing a song, you should sing it and get out of the way. I think that that's a really great way to think about it. Because, you know, what you're trying to describe if you're writing a song is or whatever you're trying to work on, any piece of art, is definitely, like, in this big kind of big way is about like being a human being. And so, like, you know, it's not providing any answers. It's giving you this, it's showing you all the questions, you know.
Right.
It's like, here's a love song. It's like, where do I go? Why did she leave? You know, what did she want? What did I do wrong? There they're all questions that you're giving, and it's and questions are the only way to really, I think, describe who we are as humans. We tend to do badly when we start coming up with answers.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
what I mean. So yeah, so like I really wanted to write songs that were that had as many of those big questions in it, because like that's all that matters. And hopefully I felt like if I kept writing as accurately as I could about these emotions and about these questions, then I would be describing something that was bigger than my own personal experience and might be like more relatable to everybody.
Yeah.
That was my hope.
With your personal experience, though, like as a songwriter, you're always looking for inspiration. Mm-hmm. It's got to come from somewhere, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sometimes you just write, you sit down, and great, a song comes too.
Yeah.
And this isn't the place that I'm sure you wanted the inspiration to come from. But as listeners, I mean, that's kind of always played out in a listener's favor for an artist to go through a bad time.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and it isn't one thing to sit back and know that we're all, like, salivating.
Uh-huh.
Let's go ahead and use salivating, like, oh, man, that sucks. Something bad happened. I bet there's going to be a great record out of this.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, it's like, it's, you know, like, I think that you know, I've written my happiest songs in my darkest time, you know,
yeah.
And like, and that's, I, you know, the, I remember I wrote a song, Snow Is Gone, on Valentine's Day after breaking up with somebody in a Chinese restaurant. And we broke up, and we didn't even have dessert, you know. And
yeah.
But I went home, but I wrote that song, and I felt really good, you know. Like those things that happen, like they happen when they do, because we're suddenly kind of blasted open, and the kind of the little birds can fly through the window, you know, and find you, you know. Those moments when you don't have all your armor on, and I think those are things that everybody has. It's just that when you're writing or you're creating something, it's illustrated, you know. Mm-hmm. But everybody, I think, has those moments of unguardedness when your world is cracked open and something new has the potential to come in and change it, you know.
Yeah. That whole we didn't even have our dessert, I think, is the saddest part of that story.
I know.
You
know? Actually, yeah.
That's a great part of the meal,
yeah,
right there.
It came with the meal too. Like the guy chased us down the street for it, so it was,
but that's not awkward at all.
No,
at that point,
it turned horrible.
I know this record, you know, is kind of looked at as your divorce record, which I guess isn't fair because it is much of what made this record is what happened after mm-hmm. that. But are you okay with it being known as that? Because there are artists, Dylan, Blood on the Tracks, mm-hmm. Marvin Gaye's Here, My Dear, mm-hmm. you know, and on Fleetwood Mac's Rumors, which I know, I think I remember reading that you took some cues from Lindsey Buckingham for this record,
oh, yeah,
too.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
There's a bit of a tie in there, but you have these great albums. Some of the greatest albums of our time were divorce records,
mm-hmm.
and while this isn't actually your technical divorce record,
yeah.
to everyone else, I guess it'll always be known as that.
I think it's fine, you know. You know, all those things are always like, if it helps people to find it, you know, that's great. I, you know, and it did come out of my divorce. It did come out of that time, and you know, if I had said nothing about it, you know, and just written the record and put it there, it would have, you know, maybe it would have gone without notice that way. But I really feel that with this was a thing that happened to me, and like it was worth it to me to tell the story about why, because I felt like, you know, I came through all that stuff, and I worked really hard on the record in a way that I hadn't before,
mm-hmm.
Mostly just kind of living through it. You know, the writing itself was really easy. It was like I saw all the emotions inside of me for the first time. I feel like I saw who I was in a way that I never had, like the good and the bad stuff, and like and just it was a more of a mapping of anything than of myself than anything else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like it was worth it to say that it was about the divorce and
yeah.
what came after, you know.
What did Nervous play anything? Because you got to know that when you put it out there, she's going to hear it.
Yeah,
you know, you're both in the same community. You're in the music
totally.
Community and everything, and I, you know, is that you go, man, I'm going to put that out there, and if I run into her at the grocery one day, I mean, that's going to be and then here
yeah.
it is. Here's our life.
Isn't that weird? It's so weird. It's so, but at the same time, like, you know, it was, you know, I felt like the desire to write about it. At first, I wanted to write about it in a very vengeful way,
mm-hmm.
and I thought,
right.
and that made me far more nervous, you know. And then I started to realize, well, this happened to me, and it happened to me, and you know, through no, I wasn't looking for this, you know, and mm-hmm. if I have to write about it, then I'm going to write about it from my point of view, and I'll just write about it as honestly as I can, and hopefully that will make it about more than my story,
yeah.
you know.
Is it hard to date a musician? And this, you're the musician too, so sure, this is not all on her.
No, I would have to say, like, I think it would be very, very hard to. I mean, it is hard to date me, but I don't think it's because of my
you
music.
You seem so sweet.
Yeah, it is. I think it is. It's not because of music, you know. I think it's just that it's just, you know, all good relationships take a lot of work, and we just didn't have it in us for the work that I would have taken.
Well, yeah. I think in our community and everything, whatever part of art it is, we marry our art first.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess the other person has to realize that, right?
Well, I think that, like, there are, you know, you make a realization that the person that you're with, there is something that is very large that is a part of them that if you are to block it off or try to restrain it, is going to end up breaking the dam that kind of holds you guys together. And, like, and that's the thing, is, like, you know, like, I'm so lucky now to be with somebody who sees my music not as being something that I do for fun all the time, but because I impulsively and compulsively do it. And that if I were to not be able to perform, if I were not be able to write, then it would destroy me.
Sure.
You know, and she loves me for that and tries to make it possible, as I do with her, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it makes all the difference.
Yeah.
There was an EP in the middle of there, and I was kind of curious because you have a track like Love Is Making Its Way Back Home.
Yeah.
And I don't know exactly where the timeline comes about, but it seems like that would have been coming out just as things were probably turning sour. Mm. Were those older songs, or were those like a spoiler alert of the album to come with the Beast in His Tracks?
They were. You know, I was really enamored with the playing of Josh Kaufman, who's an amazing guitar player, and I really liked his playing. He seemed to do what I do, but better. And he has a way of shaping how he plays to the style that you're looking for. And I just loved playing with him. He had a studio nearby me in Brooklyn, and I had like these little songs that weren't big in any way. There's no grand ambition to them. They felt kind of sleepy little lullabies that felt sweet and nice. And I thought, before I really take on these bigger songs, these songs for the Beast Nest tracks, I want to clear the deck. I want to make sure these don't get forgotten about, because oftentimes like songs will just get forgotten, you know, like you write them, feel good about them, and then you'll just forget that you even wrote them.
Sure.
You know, and so I wanted to get those done, and that was so much fun, and through the course of that, getting to work with Josh Kaufman, it was great because he was able to work with me a lot on Beast Nest tracks.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And so you've come through all of this, you've come out on the other side, mm-hmm. you seemingly have this great new thing happening in your life, and you have a kid. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So I imagine like this is probably going to direct your songwriting as well, because now you have to do it when you can. You songwrite when you can.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, that's true. You know, and I you know, now I have ideas, and I can't necessarily write them down immediately. And
yeah.
So like they have to roll around in my mind a little bit longer, and they definitely become more refined, but they also get weirder. So they're much more like colorful little marbles by the time I actually have a chance to write.
You're gonna have your weird album next.
I hope so.
I'm ready for a Josh Ritter weird album.
Psychedelic.
The Beast in Tracks is this amazing record. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thanks,
and it's going to be great to see where all this takes you.
Thanks a lot. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Josh Ritter from a 2013 interview behind his record, The Beast in Its Tracks. And again, thanks to Josh for the conversation today behind his new record again, Fever Breaks. It's so, so good. Hey, if you haven't already, hit the subscribe button before you get out of here. Again, you can subscribe to us wherever you get your favorite podcasts from, whether that's Apple Podcasts and iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, Acast, Podchaser. After that, head over to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show every Monday through Thursday from noon to 3 Eastern, where you can also find some bonus episodes of this series over there. Head to consequenceofsound.net for all your music and film news needs. You can find me at Twitter at Kyle Meredith, Facebook.com/Kyle Meredith. Does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith, and I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Assisted customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my site softer?
Can I make my site firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store and online. And now, the more you buy, the more you save on beds, bases, and more. Plus, get free premium delivery on any bed with base. Limited time. For J.D. Power 2025 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Check it out at a Sleep Number store today.